Every piece of this is man's bullshit. They call this war a cloud over the land, but they made the weather, and then they stand in the rain and say, shit, it's raining!
Welcome back to part two of the History Hour with Max Pearson. Still to come, an environmental campaigner who spent 2 years living up a tree, most famous of all the historical events linked to the accepted Christmas date in the modern calendar. 100 years ago, on Christmas Eve 1914, the fighting stopped in the trenches in France during the First World War, and there was a spontaneous truce. It was an unprecedented show of solidarity by ordinary German and British soldiers, and it's been commemorated ever since as an example of the human spirit overcoming the madness of war. Alan Johnston has listened to testimonies about that historic moment from the BBC archives.
It is Christmas Eve 1914 in the trenches in Flanders. There have been months of fighting and tens of thousands of men have been killed. But near the French town of Armentier, a calm has settled on the battlefront. It is a freezing, moonlit night, and in the silence, a young British soldier, Rifleman Graham Williams, is on sentry duty, peering out into no man's land. Many years later, he described what happened.
I was standing there on duty, gazing across, looking towards the German parapet. I thought, well, a very different Christmas this is going to be from any I've spent up till now. I thought about this time at home we should have finished putting up all the greenery and holly and stuff, and my father would have been just finished making his rum punch, which he always did at Christmas. Anyway, I thought, my word, I could just do with this figure of that rum punch now, and they're feeling pretty miserable altogether. Then all of a sudden, lights appeared all along the German trench. And I thought, well, that's a funny thing. But then the Germans started singing, Stille Nacht, Heilige Nacht. And I woke up, and all the other sentries did the same thing, all woke up the other people to come along and see this, what on earth's going on. They finished their carol. We applauded them, and then we thought we must retaliate in some way. So we replied with the first Noel. And when we finished that, they all began clapping. And then they struck up their another favourite carol of theirs, Oh Tannenbaum. First the Germans singing one of their carols, then we sing another of ours. Until we started up, Come All Ye Faithful, and the Germans immediately joined in, singing the same thing to the Latin words of Adeste Fideles. And, well, I thought this was rather an extraordinary idea, thing, really, to think of the two nations both singing the same carol in the middle of a war.
All along the front lines that night, the men of the two armies began to reach out to each other. A soldier with the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, Private Frank Richards, remembered how the men in his trench made contact with the help of a Christmas message that they'd written on a board.
We stuck a board up, Merry Christmas. They also stuck one up, Merry Christmas. So we were saying, well, I don't think they'll fire today. No, I don't think they will. Then lo and behold, here was a German coming down the river bank with his hands up above. One of our chaps threw his equipment off. He went out to meet him. Well, they shook hands. Then we all got out. Company commander come rushing in. He was going to shoot any man that went over. Some voice from the next bay said, you were too darn late. So we all had to get out. Well, we mucked in all day, talking one thing and another. One of the Germans said to me, and in excellent English too, well, he said, I don't know, he said, how long do you think this damn war's going to last? I'm fed up to the neck. Oh, I said, you are not the only one fed up. I said, we'll have to our necks in water and mud. He said, we were saying, of course, the officers had to get out then, and they sent for a couple of Germans back, and they brought some decanters, and the officers, you know, they had a damn good drink between them, see? And our company commander gave them a plum pudding, and they asked our company commander if he'd mind the company having 2 barrels of beer. He said, we've got plenty there in the brewery. He said, I can assure you, won't make them drunk. So righto, 2 Germans wheeled 2 barrels out into the middle of no man's land. We rolled them back in the trench.
And there were scenes just like the one Private Richards described up and down the battlefront. Men who had been trying to kill one another for months emerged cautiously from behind their defences, shook hands, began to chat and share their rations and drink together. And on more than one patch of no man's land, there were games of football. One reported result has a familiar feel to it. Germany 3, England 2. But what really counted was that where there had been war, suddenly, almost unbelievably, there was peace and goodwill. Years later, a German major remembered his meeting with an English officer called Sir Edward Hulse. This is what he wrote.
As regards the Christmas armistice, the initiative was not taken by us, but by the Englishmen. On Christmas Day at about 11 o'clock, there was continuous waving of a white flag from the English trench, which was about 150 yards from ours. Soon afterwards, a number of them climbed out of the trench and came towards our front, making signs all the time. My commander, Major Baron von Blomberg, ordered me to find out what they wanted. Accompanied by an English-speaking volunteer, I went out to meet the Englishmen. Under the surprised gaze of the men in the trenches on both sides, the preliminary greetings exchanged were of a rather embarrassed nature. We heard that it was the wish of the Englishmen to bury, on the Christmas holiday, their dead, who were lying before the front, and they asked us to cease enemy action for an adequate period. What were we to do? Time was short. There was no time for making inquiries of the superior department. Major von Blomberg therefore decided that there should be a local armistice until 1 o'clock in the afternoon, telling the Englishmen that their dead must be buried by that time. While the English soldiers performed their sad task, I chatted with the then Lieutenant Sir Edward Hulse, and I handed him a Victoria Cross and letters which had belonged to an English captain who had fallen in our trench in the course of the attack of December the 18th. Touched by this respectful treatment of the belongings of one of his fallen comrades, Lieutenant Hulse took off his silk shawl and handed it to me as a memento of this Christmas Day. I felt so embarrassed by this gesture that I sent to the lieutenant on the same evening, from my Christmas gifts, a pair of fur gloves. Only on New Year's Day, when a single shot, fired from the English, killed a sentry, did this Christmas peace, which I shall never forget, come to an end.
Nowhere would the truce hold for more than a matter of days. The British and German generals had been astonished at the reports of camaraderie in no man's land. On both sides, they issued the sternest orders. There was to be no more fraternization with the enemy. Informal truces were to cease, and there were threats of court-martials. Gradually, all along the line, gunshots began to ring out again. Snipers started picking off their targets once more, and over time there was a return to all-out war. It would last for nearly 4 more years, and by the time the conflict ended, millions of soldiers had been killed. For many of those men who ventured out into no man's land during the truce, that Christmas in 1914 would be their last. Among them was the English officer who gave away his silk shawl as a gift and received the gloves in return. Sir Edward Hulse was killed in battle less than 3 months later.
Such a powerful image, that the lowly foot soldiers reaching out to each other across a frozen no man's land on Christmas Day.
That was... Yes, you wonder where the white people have gone. You've been killing each other for hundreds of years. That's where you've gone. White Aryan resistance calling. White Aryan resistance calling. This is White Aryan resistance, and this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker. on a cool, overcast morning. We've had a lot of these lately, but no snow. that's a good thing. I don't mind a little snow, maybe up to about 5 inches. Yeah, but when we get that foot snow, 2 foot and 4 foot, that's a problem. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where we hang out. That's where you send your donations for the radio show and for other projects, including the POWs. And go on up to resist.com. There's a lot of things up there you might want to order. Some of them we you pay for, and a lot of them it's free. The website's full of free stuff. And free radio shows, too. Can't complain about our prices are too high because we run this thing at poverty rates. But I'm not complaining, not complaining. Yeah. Now, back in September 26th to 28th of this year, I did something I always wanted to do and hadn't done it since we got back here from California. But we went to the 39th annual Fairmont Museum Days, the 35th annual James Dean Run. There were hundreds of Harleys down there and other kinds of bikes, and there were thousands of people came in for this James Dean 35th annual get-together. And in the process, I picked up two posters, beautiful posters, showing the home of the museum and where James Dean family had lived in early on. We got to tour all the places where he hung out and all that kind of stuff. And on the front is a beautiful picture of James Dean in color. And a 50 Mercury, one of those ones he drove in the movie. And all down skirts on it and customized and the whole bit. I think he Rebel Without a Cause where he drove that Mercury. Know it well because I drove a 49 Mercury in high school, and it wasn't as pretty as this one, but it was pretty nice. It was like sitting in your living room in that car. Well, anyhow, I picked up two of these posters, and I'm sending one to my grandson in California, and I got one left here. And I'm willing to put it on the block for anyone who wants to make a donation. I'll send it to you, and I'll put my signature on it too. And the highest bid gets it. And I think you'll like this, especially if you were a fan of James Dean and his movies and custom cars and all that kind of stuff. So anyhow, it's here. And if I don't get bids on it, well, I'll send it to one of my other grandkids. Maybe one of the girls. I think I put this out before, but I have at least one inmate. He's not a POW. He didn't go in there for race, I don't believe, but he was involved in the skinhead struggle for a long time. And so he is a racist, and he features himself as a war associate. And he's one of the few people that I find can receive CDs in the prison. And he just loves those skinhead music CDs. So if any of you people out there have some spares that you don't need or tired to listen to, send them to me and I'll send them to him, because I sent him two about 3 weeks ago and he got them. Finally, after quite a while, and we finally figured it out. And he was just thrilled as hell to get them. So anyhow, friend George Loeb, the POW down in Florida, they're giving him a hard time. A lot of times I send him something that I can send to any other prison and it gets through. It's a federal case down there. It's a state prison, and those are worse than the federal prisons, to be perfectly honest. And so he's sending in grievances all the time. But I'm going to continue to try to push through books to him. I've got some sources for some pretty cheap books. I ordered the Bible, the Devil's book, yesterday for Dennis Mahon, and I got it for, I think it was $8. Now, anything under 10 or not very much over 10 is a good deal to send to POWs. But we need to send them as much as possible from the publisher, because most prisons give you all kinds of trouble if you don't go through the publisher. But a lot of these publishers got a hell of a lot of the books that we like. So anyhow, that's to remember. Amazon Amazon seems to be the best. And there's Abe Books, A-B-E, and like that. So if you want to send a book to one of the POWs listed on our website, well, just order it from the publisher and put their address on it. And if you don't want your own name on it as a return, well, you can put mine on there and do that, because they love the books and magazines. Send them a magazine subscription. I know I sent a subscription to Mother Jones, to Richard Scutari, and I renewed it for the next year. A lot of good stuff in there. It obviously comes more from the left, but there's a hell of a lot of good stuff in there. Hell of a lot more than you'll get from the right-wing conservative neocons. But Scutari tells me he doesn't want any more books. He gets too many books in his cell. And so he knows pretty much the whole score anyhow. And he's trying to get his parole set up and like that. But you can send these guys articles, photocopies good articles. And I do it all the time, and either put one, or sometimes if it's a little thick, you put two stamps on it. I just walk over here, take a book, photocopy a chapter or two or whatever, and slap them in an envelope, and away they go. And they really like that. And I got a lot of these POWs send me stamps. If they send me stamps, I say, give me 5 stamps a month. Some of them give me more than that. Then I'll send them something every month. And so they really like that, too. I haven't heard any more about what the condition of Gary Yarbrough is. For some reason, my communications with that group over there is not too good. But anyhow, if I find out what's going on with Gary Yarbrough, I'll let you know. Just remember, it's lone wolves now. The werewolves are on vacation for a while. You never know when those werewolves might show up. I see that New York, Ukraine, Western Ukraine, is trying to starve out the Russian people on the east, where they're the separatist group. So they're even evidently building concentration camps to keep those people in. So isn't that nice? You see, this government's never seen a war criminal that they didn't support. That's because why? Our government is a collection of war criminals, probably some of the worst that there's ever been, because they not only use physical means, they use psychological means. I mean, you know, it's always easy to talk about physical torture and so forth, but what about mental torture and psychological torture, which our government loves? I watched for the second time the Manchurian Candidate, the latest one, with the black boy, and he did a good job, and it was a good movie. I had only watched part of it one time because I liked the original better, but one of our she-wolves sent me a copy of it in DVD, and I played it. And if you want to know how rotten governments are and corporations are and how they work together, it's a good film to watch. Which reminds me of that Louis Theroux documentary, that crazy Louis Theroux thing. I remember when he said, do you think you're as good looking as Denzel Washington? And I said, of course. You know, the funny thing about it is you can't compare white men to black men as far as beauty or handsomeness is concerned. I know within each group there's a wide variation. But it was a stupid question. And rather than leave an opening for some other stupid question, I said, of course I'm better looking than Denzel Washington. I should have said, well, if you go back to if my age was the same as his, you'd know that. So anyhow, we get a big laugh out of that. And all the race mixers that email me and stuff like that, they always make that a big deal. You think you're better looking than Denzel Washington. Well, hell, I'm a white man. I don't compare myself to no nigger. Remember, in a racial war, which you're in no matter whether you believe it or not, you need to understand something so that you understand what you're dealing with. In my case, I revived a word that I never used in years past, and that's nigger. Because we have niggers and we have mulattoes. And there's a growing population of mulattoes. They're a bastard race. They're not white. They're not black. And so when you say a nigger, to be perfectly honest, I have more confidence as far as stability in a black nigger than a mulatto. Your president today exhibits all the downfall of the mulatto people. He's a mulatto. They're unstable. And if you look in animal husbandry and veterinarians, crossbreeding animals, it's the same thing. You get unstable outcomes. You try to, if you don't breed well and breed with race horses, you come up with unstable horses that can't be used. So anyhow, if anybody asks you why you say nigger, say, well, I have to delineate so that you understand nigger is the black Negro, and mulatto is these half-breeds. And they're more dangerous, much more dangerous than the black man. Because the black man, no matter how equal or unequal we think he is more stable and more stable. That's just the way it is. And I think most people that have dealt with the black race for quite some time can see that. Well, I continue with the Adolf Hitler, the founder of Israel, the father of Israel. In 1932, the SA alone cost about 180 million marks, with the other expenses of party employees, election campaigns, and airplane travels, the amount came to 300 million marks. You see, any kind of politics or revolution costs money, which is something these Jewish acting right-wingers never learned. About one-sixth of this sum came from dues and donations of the party members. At the end of 1933, a very well-known Dutch publishing house, after a study of documents, issued a report about the shabbiest rest a few hundred million marks spent throughout the years. The report disclosed many names, and soon after its publication, it was sold out. Nobody then complained, but during the occupation of Holland, all documents were destroyed, and the publisher, Shoup, found his death at the hands of the Gestapo. The report showed that at one time, $10 million and another time, $15 million were transferred by the bank house of Mendelssohn and Company in Amsterdam. With similar sums operated other houses, Kuhn Loeb and Company, J.P. Morgan, and Samuel & Samuel, which were not restricted by a fixed playing field. The Swiss man, René Sondrager, in his book Spanish Summer, published in Suisse, 1948, I believe Suisse is in Switzerland, had disclosed the messenger who was delivering monies to Hitler, the man whom bankers sent to Germany to test the question of a German revolution, was the young Warburg, Jew. He was smart, educated, and possessed good manners, and had mastered the German language perfectly when he worked several years in the bankhouse of his uncle in Hamburg. Warburg, equipped with the highest regards, found himself in Germany and soon met Hitler in Munich. Hitler was very pleased to have shaken hands with this rich American. And then H.R. Knickerbocker, world widely known American journalist, forecasted in his 1932 book, Deutschland so oder so, German like this or like that, exactly this. The American investments in the European continent are the best, but only on the battlefields. See that? They're making the best money, best profits off war. Of special benefit was also Sir Henry de Terding of the Royal Dutch Shell Company, whose money came through the Samuel & Samuel of London. Incidentally, it's a side issue that David Duke's father was somewhat of a big shot in Shell Oil. Even after Hitler's seizure of power, this oil man continued to spend money on Hitler. A hint of this may be found in the Hamburger Fremdenblad, foreign newspaper of Hamburg, of February 15, 1939. In 1937, 10 million guldens were transferred over. A few days before this information appeared, Sir Henry expired in St. Moritz and was buried ceremoniously in Dobbin, Mecklenburg. Country Bishop Schultz, a party member from Schwerin, honored him with a passage, quote, "With the boldness of Napoleon, with the spiritual power of Cromwell, he had fought against the spirit of destruction and degradation of all human rights by the deeds prerequisite to saving the world from communism," unquote. You see, for good or bad, communism was always used as the bogeyman. Just like they do nowadays with countries. In this country, they say, "Oh, we got to watch out for Iran. Iran's going to get us." You know, the communists in Russia did not have the strength, or finances, or power to seriously threaten Germany. I know, there are going to be a whole lot of people out there argue about that, but I've researched it pretty well, and I can share that with you, too, one of these days. The founder of Shell, Marcus Samuel, a Jew, was a supporter of Sir Henry de Terding. Once he collected shells in East Asia and in London, he turned them into money. Hence, he gave his company a Shell logo and brand name. During the oil boom of the First World War, get that? The oil boom of the First World War, from Samuel's company emerged in a nobleman, Bursted, whose shell of Baku in 1918 was expropriated by the Soviets without any compensation. In Hitler's Third Reich, the rights of the Russian oil companies were revoked, so Samuel's shell raced to fill in the gap. Heinrich Mann, a writer and brother of Thomas Mann, shortly before the end of the Second World War, was urged to say a word to Berliners, quote, "Now you can know how it really was. Violence was the main obstacle to your revolution. Several trust magnates held your social movement back by using it against the nations. Their commander, Hitler, was un-German, just like them," unquote. Heinrich Mann came to speak right from New York. The Neue Zürcher Zeitung, which was a New Zurich's newspaper, number 758 of May 1946, wrote, "When shocked," and he was the head of the Reichsbank, during the Nuremberg trial talked about the attitude of foreign powers towards the Nazi government and the help they conferred upon it, the court decided that these things had nothing to do with the trial matter and therefore were inadmissible. The financing of the war is inadmissible in Nuremberg. Gives you an idea of what went on there. Either one, Hitler or Gregor Strasser, leader of the organization of the Reich's office, accepted revenues from large Jewish banks. You see, a lot of writers write about how American banks invested in Germany and the Nazis, but they don't zero in too much on the Jews that were involved in these banks. The chief of the news services of the Reich Army, General von Bredow, knew about this very well. On June 30, 1934, during the Night of the Long Knives, von Bredow and Gregor lost their lives too. Knowledge is not only power, but it can also be dangerous to know where all the skeletons are. And we got a lot of skeletons in the right wing closet, I'll tell you that. Dr. Aberg, chief of the Prussian police from 1926 until 1932, fled to Switzerland with documents pertaining Hitler's foreign financing, and in Zurich built the famous Abig archives. He informed the public about Hitler's documents carrier. Quote, documents concerning the secret funds were located in a furniture truck. In between 1929 and 32, the truck constantly rolled back and forth between Berlin and Munich. This way, the truck could neither be taken by the Prussian or by the Bavarian police. During the 1930 parliamentary Reichstag election, the National Socialists won 6,401,210 votes. The 107 political representatives of this party, instead of the usual 12, moved into the Reichstag, all of them, of course, in brown shirts. Authorities in power agitated people to vote efficiently, for as Democrats they wanted to know what was going on. Finally, they got it. In July 32, almost 14 million Germans voted for Hitler, and his party by far was the biggest. To the presidency over the Reichstag, called by National Socialists Young's Parliament, remember Young was an American, was raised Hermann Göring, the restlessly walking preacher of the German movement, who more than often switched from his fast Mercedes limousine to an even faster party-owned airplane. Only twice in those years of successes experienced misfortunes. Both times they were personal ones, of course, with political overtones. Alois Hitler's older half-brother left home early and caused a lot of mischief. He was jailed for theft and bigamy. Among other things, he produced a son in Ireland who is known as William Patrick Hitler. Behaved as if he was struck by lightning. To this sprout of kinship, the regular work was a contrary thing, and so he rebelled. Supposedly, I should earn 125 marks, but on this starvation I can neither live or die, unquote. For this reason, in 1930, nothing seemed to be more natural to him than to blackmail his wealthy uncle, Adolf, using the Jewish origin of his grandfather as a tool. He was hinting that in connection with some newspaper statement, there would be a great deal of interest in making certain facts public regarding the history of our family, unquote. So an attorney was needed, and at hand was the cunning Hans Frank, who, when called, sat across from the Führer in his 9-bedroom parlor suite at the Prinzenplatz in Munich, and in anticipation of something good, listened, quote, "It is disgusting and blackmailing story," started Hitler. Quote, "Please look, my dear Frank, you know who is your honorable father, also a Jew, but a German through many generations, and not one of these Galicia's kaftan wears, Eastern Jew. Do you know how it is when one can't see clearly anymore? Who is my grandfather, father of my father? There are Frankenbergers, enormously rich Jews, who paid for this upbringing for 14 years when no one else wanted to do so. They are a nice pack. Take this story and get the blackmailer off my back, unquote. Hitler sat up straight and continued, quote, my dear comrade Frank, the matter of your origins someone may bring up too, I promise you. I do have means, and I will help you with this. Alike, I help my friend Hoffman. Hoffman was his cameraman and aide. Then he jumped out of the chair and opened a drawer. Quote, here, take this, and handed the young attorney a bundle of money. Quote, go on traveling right away, and tell me when you will need more money. I have to get this matter off my back, unquote. Thus, in 1930, Hans Frank became the searcher of Hitler's ancestors, spending more time in Austria than in the old country Vienna. Graz and the Memorial Forest were his favorable destinations. The fact that on each visit, the Austrian authorities treated the archive searcher as an unwanted foreigner bothered Frank very little. Finally, he clarified everything just the way it should be. During the war, places of Hitler's deep roaming in the forest land gave way to the important military training grounds. This permitted Hitler to breathe more easily. On the same occasion, many documents disappeared pertaining to the origin of Frank. About this, in face of death in his Nuremberg cell, he had written, there was also a correspondence between the Frankenbergers and Hitler's grandmother, which lasted for years. The general tendency of all concerned parties was to silence the very public opinion that Schicklgruber's illegitimate child was under care of Frankenberger's alimony obligations. I have to say that it cannot be excluded that Hitler's father was half-Jew, born from Schicklberger, close relationship with a Jew of Graz. According to this, Hitler was a quarter Jew. This explains his hatred toward the Jews. He's a self-hating Jew, which stems from the blood-related anti-kinsman psychosis, unquote. Since these shady deals became publicly known all over Austria and the Austrian Supreme Court, within the Reichscourt after annexation, a position was established with Frank as the attorney of state. This position permitted him to take care of child support applications by Aryans who gave birth to illegitimate children. In order to receive child support, it was sufficient for a mother to state that she only assumes that the fathering was done by a Jew. The other misfortune in those years was a similar kind. In Linz, when Hitler, on a cloudy December day of 1907, accompanied his mother to her grave, his older half-sister, Angela, followed in a horse buggy. She was in her last days of pregnancy. The happy event of birth took place within the first few days of the new year, and afterwards her lovely girl developed well to the excitement of all. She was named Angela, for short, Gelly. Her mother, a young widow, was an upright person, and in Vienna made a living as a cook in a Jewish community kitchen. After her brother made money through his book Mein Kampf, he hired her as a housekeeper on his Haus Wachenfeld, home of the weapons field, down in Berchtesgaden. The pretty college graduate, Gelly, who wanted to study music, moved into Uncle Adolf's big apartment in Munich. Things went along quite naturally until late summer 1931, when Gelly found herself pregnant. For that, she was very happy, but Uncle Adolf suggested abortion. This caused among them a big quarrel. One beautiful September morning, just as the housekeeper went out to buy bread, some thoughts overwhelmed Gelly. Quote, you have learned too much about Mendel, about hereditary laws, and about hereditary science. You are scared that your Jewish blood will be at work and bow-legged child with curly hair will be born. This is rubbish, I say, a rubbish thought, I say, unquote. And a shot was heard. Gelly died from a bullet in her heart. Hitler received the gruesome message by phone call from Hess' secretary in a bar while on a car trip to Nuremberg with his close friend Hoffman, a photographer, and this was unbelievable to him. About noon, he was back in Munich, completely broke, and announced that he will commit suicide. But the attending Hess took the pistol away from his hand. Hitler threatened to abandon everything, but the party members who were weeping with him advised not to do so and encouraged him not to give in to the cruel fate. Dr. Gertner, the powerful Bavarian justice, took it upon himself the task of finding the murderer, but concluded that it was a suicide. The same Dr. Gertner became the Secretary of Justice of the Third Reich. Hitler also had his own confession pastor, Father Stempfel, who was an enemy of the Jews. On June 30, 1934, during the Night of the Long Knives, he was liquidated, with Hitler crying, quote, "They murdered my poor Father Stempfel," unquote. Shortly after that, two perpetrators were rewarded with promotions. The Catholic Church does not bury suicide victims in holy soil, but the priest who buried Gelly in the Vienna cemetery did, thus letting a doubtful Otto Strasser know that, quote, "Out of this single fact that I gave her a Christian burial, you should draw the proper conclusion," unquote. The Hitler researcher Conrad Haydn, in an introduction to 1936 Hitler's biography, wrote, quote, "The statement has been changed only at one point, for the death of Angela Rubel, to me, doesn't seem to be a suicide anymore," unquote. And in 1944, on page 388, he added, quote, "Father Stempfel knew that Gelly's unborn child was fathered by her uncle." In 1969, about this point, commented suspiciously short another Hitler biographer, Alan Bullock, quote, "It is best to keep the case of Gelly Rabl a secret," unquote. These types of contradictions in the Führer's life did not hinder American money from streaming in. For 1 million marks, the party was able to purchase its Brown House in Munich. Only two of the four of the over 40 parties in the German Reich won considerable numbers of members and votes, the NSDAP and the Communist Party of Germany, the latter financed by the East. No capitalist, it seems to me like the real being pissed off at the communists had a lot to do with, and the East had to do, and being pissed off at these Eastern Jews was the fact that they were supporting communism. No capitalist likes to lose an effortless snatching of money. But the Wall Street, by investing billions of dollars into Germany, was acting logically, for it put millions antagonism between Western and Eastern Jews did not play a decisive role here. The calculation was simple. If Hitler goes to war, which is not improbable, certainly Wall Street will not become poorer. Hitler proclaimed many times and openly that the American capital investments in Germany will be more secure under National Socialist government than under any other government. Why, then, Bruning, the Chancellor of the Reich, was doubtful, unquote. The party leader flew by plane and delivered speeches, rode in motorized colonnades across the country, and also delivered speeches. Quote, "Don't lose your faith in the future of our people, of our great fatherland, in this victory in the struggle for our just cause which serves them both. As long as I live, I belong to you, and you belong to me." This tactic worked everywhere, and the British military attaché, Thorne, wrote to his ambassador in Berlin all these cadres combined feel that the Nazi movement is the best available. One for keeping the youth of the country disciplined. This will also keep them off the road to communism. So I hope you see by now this cleavage between the Ashkenazim and the Sephardim and the Jews of the West. The Sephardim, who had been there for a long, long time, had pretty much integrated into the German nation. I mean, they had some Ashkenazim. These are the ones that primarily that they wanted to get rid of. And I think that several countries wanted to keep them out. So you see that the New York bankers, the Jew bankers, were pretty much, they were Sephardim. And they didn't care what Hitler did with the Ashkenazi. It's pretty plain if you read on both sides what was going on and why they asked, well, why didn't the New York bankers and the rich Jews in New York do something for these Ashkenazim Jews? For much of them were Ashkenazim. There were some Western poor Sephardics caught in this problem. Well, that's why they didn't care about them. Everybody wanted to keep the Ashkenazi, greasy little, kinky-haired, hook-nosed Jews from the East out. And so their brethren, so-called brethren Sephardim, said, yeah, keep them out. And so that's an important part of this. And that's why Hitler did a lot of business and had a lot of people that were Sephardim and partially Sephardim, including himself. It gets quite confusing. And then you have the specter of Jewish Orthodoxy from the East and also in the West, muddying the water. And then you had the newer form of Judaism in the Christian churches, muddying the water, and it's a mess. It was, the whole thing was a mess, and led to total destruction is what it did. I remember reading about this in other books where the Sephardim, the Anglo-looking, Germanic-looking Jews that were living in Germany were beside themselves with these Eastern Jews coming in to what was their turf and setting up tables on the street and dealing and loaning money off little card tables in the street. And I've got that book around here that's got that in, how appalled they were at these little kinky-haired bastards from the East, the Ashkenazim. A lot of this is why the right-wing kind, I guess, can never figure this stuff out. They don't realize the cleavage between the Sephardim and the Ashkenazim. There's so many things they don't realize. And until they do, they'll never... It's a bucket of eels to try to figure out. Slogan, quote, Jews are our bad luck, unquote, dominated all the speeches rendered from the industrialists. Party leaders on the right and on the left, in the marketplaces, in the halls, and in many variations everywhere, depended on the audience. Sometimes thousands of people were waiting in the rain, still at 3 o'clock in the morning, for late arrival of the Führer's airplane, which was late due to bad weather conditions. But at last he came, and they saw him and listened. Here's a picture in here of Goebbels looking at Hitler like he wants to kiss him, where it says, Adolf Hitler thanks his first propagandist, Dr. Joseph Goebbels, who significantly contributed to Hitler's success in seizing power, and later he belonged to the war, prolonged the war. He was born to Spanish Dutch Jews in school. He was called the rabbi. His Jewish mother-in-law, Friedlander, lived in his household until the end of the war. Okay, there's a bunch of other pictures in here. I won't go into that. Well, anyhow, they're waiting in the rain for their idol, who was rescuing them from their humiliation and poverty of the Weimar Republic. You see, there was never an end to World War I. There was only World War I. And everything that happened from World War I spilled over and created what you call World War II. There never would have been a Hitler if there hadn't been a World War I, or if it had a different outcome. And Jews made all this easy for the speaker of masses. They also talked about the terrible things, including gassing. Quote, let the gas sneak into the playroom of their children so that they can slowly expire along with their dolls. We wish that the wives of the church committee men and the chief editors, the mothers of sculptors and sisters of bankers, all of them together find a bitter and agonizing death. Whoever leaves this fatherland in the lurch will be blessed, unquote. I don't know exactly where that came from. Fighting all of this with no holds barred, but mostly through the magazine World Stage, was an Eastern Jew, Tucholsky, under aliases of Ignaz Wrobel, Kaspar Hauser, Theobald Tiger, and Peter Painter. Before 1933, the Jewish population in Germany was about 1%. Now, that's a very small population of Jews. Now, I can see why the Sephardim were aghast at all these seedy, swarthy little Jews coming in from the East. Over 50% of the news media, movie industry, and banking operations were in Jewish hands. In Berlin, 55% of the lawyers and 52% of the physicians were Jewish. 15 Jews controlled 718 positions on the board of directors. Sounds like the United States. Foreigners who visited Berlin and experienced life only at the Kadam Road corner, popular tourist street in Berlin, or other nightly excitements, with delight talked or wrote about the Golden Twenties, where they could not find their unemployment, the hungry or part-time workers. In 1930, a Western Jew, Stern, who was best known as the Lord Rothermore, a British newspaper magnate and brother of another newspaper magnate, Lord Northcliffe, judged the situation in this way, quote, when we will take a closer look at the transition of political power to National Socialists, we will find that it has many advantages. First of all, it erects a strong barrier against Bolshevism. And when they say Bolshevism, they're also talking about Ashkenazim in the East. In Germany, it eliminates the serious danger of Soviet advances against European civilization and their win of an invincible position in the strategic center of Europe. You see, all systems do this, whether they're right or wrong. It's always, they're coming to get us, so we got to do something else. We got to do this. Things that you probably wouldn't do if you didn't have the scare factor. In his book published in 1939, Stern Rothermore stated, quote, Hitler suffered due to the incompetence of his ruling men. He found it offensive that members of a foreign race could conduct business in Germany or Austria excellently, while his own countrymen starved in poverty, unquote. Emigres in their Paris daily paper reported that the German Jews bargained with the Brown House in Munich about setting up a special Jewish formations within the SA, for nothing is more popular than success. And there were, early on, there were a lot of Jews that wanted in, a lot of other Jews that weren't already in. Yeah. And then they went to, a lot of them wanted to go into fascism, and they almost did. And of course, I guess you would call the Zionism a form of fascism. Individuals and entire social groups obviously are expected too much from uneasy coupling of nationalism with socialism. Furthermore, Hitler, before the economists in Hamburg in Ruhr Basin, or the unemployed people in the sports palace in Berlin, or before the indebted farmers of Mecklenburg, spoke not about the promises but about the future plans of developments. The confusion created by Hitler's statements regarding socialism and so-called agreements with Jewish financiers was evident everywhere. Section 17 of the party's program provided for non-pecuniary expropriation of land. Hitler explained before the doubting peasants that, quote, because the roots of the NSDAP stem in the private ownership of land from which NSDAP developed itself, the phrase non-pecuniary expropriation only has an application to cases where the land was not legally acquired or, in the people's view, is improperly managed. Then, if need be, it should be expropriated. First and foremost was the directed towards Jewish land speculators. But you see, here's the problem. See, the original National Socialism wanted to break up the big agricultural trusts. And these old families that through all kinds of conniving had held on to vast amounts of German land, and the National Socialists wanted to break that up, redistribute the land, which I agree. I'm sorry, right-wingers. Sometimes things get so installed and last so long and are built on such corruption that you got to shake the bush. And we get all excited when they do that in these other countries in South America, which I agree they have every right to do. And, of course, even Castro, that's what he was doing. So, but they always make that a horrible deal. Well, they don't talk about the horror that installed all this capital in the hands of a few. But when they are asked to fess up, they squeal like little pigs. When someone requested Mr. Goebbels to explain what the socialism means, he responded tangibly, but with a Levantic philosophy. Quote, the National Socialism is not yet fully defined, but in the stage of creation, it is still modified, and for this reason, it cannot be totally embraced. But you see, National Socialism was already truly formed. But after the Long Knives, they wanted to get rid of it. Corresponding to this were the conjectures of the foes within the socialist camp. In the beginning, the inflexible Adolf Hitler was acting decently. Today is only a creature of big industry. See, that's when they went to national capitalism, and that's what the Night of the Long Knives and the agreements between Thyssen and Hitler and his SS and all that came about. They switched over. Does anybody really think that the iron and coal magnates would give away their mighty pecuniary to the Union, whose goal is to expropriate them and later on to honor Teutonic God by hanging them on the nearest street lamp? They're afraid of labor. Here's a party that promoted labor, but then in reality, they're not going to do a lot for labor, or at least they're not going to touch the rich corporations. Also, Mr. Tucholsky, who wrote under many pseudonyms, seemed to be in a great despair. Quote, so this is internal politics? No, it's not what you think. A couple of prisons, a dose of brutality against the Jews, against a handful of Republicans, a curtailed state banner, a prohibition of the German Communist Party, it is nothing else, unquote. Just recently immigrated to the U.S., Albert Einstein saw the whole thing and the Wall Street's financial support not particularly bad. Quote, in the National Socialist Movement, Einstein said, I see only a temporary consequence of the currently critical situation as an illness of a newborn republic, referring to the Soviet Weimar Republic. Solidarity of the Jews is always appropriate, for a specific reaction regarding the election results is necessary, unquote. That's from Albert Einstein. The former Justice Minister of State, Otto Landsberg, and a member of the German Socialist Party, calmed himself and others about what is to be expected. Quote, "You're still an unexperienced colleagues who are overestimate at the danger which comes from those Jewish baiters. Personally, I saw such anti-Semitic sentiments flowing in and out. In the 80s, in my home city of Ostrowo, Russia's Poland, these sentiments were strong, and my brother in a college suffered there a lot. When a few years later I visited the same college, these sentiments weren't there anymore. It would be wrong to treat such baiters seriously," unquote. And the Prussian Premier Braun, also from the GSP, described the overall confusion, which everyone ascribed to Hitler, as follows. Quote, "This prototype of a political adventurism, which through the filthy gold well of the rotten demagogic agitation of all the desperados and hope losers, as well as the familiar circles of the capitalistic profiteers of a reactionist conviction lacking judgment about today's state of the people, with the enemy's deadly opposition on how to ruin it, despite of all it has created, is a nebulous Third Reich which must be won, as Hitler promised to all the citizens on everything they wish, and at any cost of its various components." In May 1930, the youngest brother of Dr. Gregor Strasser, Otto, in consideration of the substantial unsupportive capital, wanted to know what really was the position of socialists in the NSDAP. The well-known pact between Hitler and the mighty economics and industrial powers had bothered him, as well as Gregor and others. By then he published the Letters of National Socialism, which made his position in the party strong, and his decisive discussion with Hitler in presence of his brother Gregor in Berlin's Hotel Sensuka made it even stronger. Regardless of this, Dr. Strasser's worries did not diminish. Hence, he recalled the discussion not too enthusiastically. Hitler's opinion about the tenets of socialism was clear. Quote, "Look here, party comrade Strasser, an owner of a factory depends on the production means and his employees' eagerness to work. When they go to strike, then his so-called property becomes completely worthless." Well, that's ridiculous. "Besides, on what grounds are these workers demanding to take over the property or its management?" And then Hitler continued furiously. Quote, "Look, most of the workers want nothing more than bread and entertainment, as they have no interest in great ideals." A lot of respect for the working class. So for this reason, we cannot really count on winning them over in considerable numbers." Huh? I thought you were a national socialist. "We needed to select a new gentleman shift." It sounds like the national socialists in this country. They talk, they have a great reverence for the warfare of the Germans and all that kind of stuff, and the parades of the Germans and the wars that Germany was following, but when it comes to other things, and it comes to labor and environment and all that, they're not around. The gentlemanship, which will be driven not by somebody's compassionate morass, but specifically by mustering up superb racial bases, such as a rule without any conditions attached thereto, will be preserved and secured by a massive support. Now, you see where I tell you that, and I've said on television, that the capitalists will use racism when it's in their interest, but cynically and not really caring. This was what was going on, getting people just riled up and talking too much race. Now, remember, this is a country that's 99% white. To keep their mind a little bit away from the labor class and the working class and their problems and collective bargaining. They didn't want any collective bargaining. So they should have dropped the socialism out of the party name completely. After this dictum, Strasser, a former member of the German Socialist Party, said to his boss with all the courage, "Honorable Hitler, if you will uphold the capitalistic system, then you cannot talk about socialism. Then our party's adherents will be socialist in the first place, and then they will act accordingly with the party's program, which particularly promotes socialism of the corporate business," unquote. To this, the recalcitrant Strasser got this reply from Hitler: "Your interpretation of socialism is wrong, for it does not mean that these businesses must be socialized, nor that they can be socialized. Specifically, if it were to be done not for a benefit of the nation. So far, this has not been done. Otherwise, a crime would have been committed and the economy disarray. In reality, for the sound economy, there is only one solution: a responsible lifted up and authority elevated down," unquote. You can explain that to me, I'll tell you. After this explanation, Hitler hastily produced a note and passed it to the governor of Berlin, Joseph Goebbels, with an order. Quote, "Otto Strasser and his associates must be thrown out from the party in disgrace. As long as I will govern the NSDAP, it will not be a disputant club of literates without roots or of chaotic Solon Bolsheviks. It was not created in order to indoctrinate political fools or the wandering birds." Strasser, who did not find socialism in the NSDAP, went under a different banner. His proclamation read, quote, "Socialists leave the NSDAP," and he released his rage over the Oriental Sultanate of Hitler freely. "We find ourselves in opposition to the 25 sections of the National Socialist Party program, which are a part of our washed-out socialist formulas." Now, this was before the Night of the Long Knives, when this struggle was going on. And Hitler was destroying the socialist part of the party, of which most of these guys, that's the reason they joined up. They were tired of finance capital. Let's see here. In the process of offending the spirit of National Socialist Program, they watered it down. Thus now, with relentless consequences, came to the light the betrayal by the NSDAP of its basic principles. To the socialist opposition, together with Otto Strasser, went several editors and half of the party's newspapers, various leaders of the Hitler Youth movement, a couple of party functionaries, and finally some provincial and state officials, all of which later were called the Black Front. But the majority of party comrades stayed faithful to the Führer and Brother Gregor during the next 2 years. Hitler, now with big money, stormed forward from one success to another. And this, of course, came from the New York banks and Jews and in the West and other sources and the industrialists of Germany. And they loved it because Hitler was preparing for war, and what does an arms maker love more than that? Hitler, now with big money, stormed forward from one success to another. Otto Strasser, with the people on of the left on his right, in his further political life was homeless and unlucky. After Hitler's seizure of power, his closest Jewish friend, Marr, in exile in Prague, who was drafting and smuggling leaflets to the Reich, disappointed him once again. Marr, a skilled cooperative, was active at the first front line with Himmler's SS and was guided by soon-to-be-promoted Heydrich, a three-quarter Jew of the racist elitary order society, but finally was arrested by the Czechoslovakian police and put behind bars for 1 year. The same fate met another Jewish agent of the SS by the name of Pollock, who was sniffing amongst the immigrants. In due time, it also came to hunt for the extra National Socialist Strasser from one country to another, and as far as Canada he ran, where during the war he found asylum. In the middle 50s, 10 years after the war, the straightforward fighter for Hitler was once again disappointed because his supporters of the Federal Republic of Germany did not allow him to enter his fatherland, where after subduing many obstacles on his way home, he was rebuked and got into some trouble. When Strasser whistled, then all the judges of the Republic's courts in Karlsruhe, mostly former party comrades, pointed their fingers at him as the one for whose head Hitler designated a 1 million mark reward for his death. His support of then just created the NSDAP was more significant than his latter opposition to it. So turns the world. Into the, quote, help prisoners office of the SA burst a pig snout, a very well-known pillar of brawls, and his hanging lips and articulate and limited words, he reported to a noble Miss Jolin von Pescatori, visiting behind a typewriter. Quote, Blondie, Blondie, we are sunk in the bucket. The Fuhrer bought a Mercedes for $40 million, 40 million marks. So the SA has a crackling in the soup, unquote. The SA rebelled and the connection with Otto Strasser was broken, as with his speeches and news articles, and unmistakably too. Well, I see that's about it for today. I hope we don't bore you too much, but I want it out there, so after I kick the bucket, because I don't think, well, there may be others follow and do this, but you're not going to find any of them in the right wing, and the Hitler worshippers are going to do this, so I'm doing it. 14-5, and shut your mouth, and walk, lone wolf. Think werewolf.